Please silence all electronic devices.
Members, the nurse of the day today is...
The job we have as legislators is to decide where the lines are.
It is a very sacred and holy institution.
I'll move to amend the bill.
Even the old folks in Devon knew.
He said, hey, ain't you Jesse Harrell? And I couldn't deny that. I said, yeah.
I'm Elizabeth Dole, and I approve this message.
While I do not believe I did anything illegal or ever thought I was doing anything illegal...
You're fired.
North Carolina General Assembly Act.
Any further discussion or debate?
This is the WUNC Politics Podcast. I'm Dave DeWitt, Managing Editor for News here at WUNC. And I'm here with Jess Clark Fletcher, Fellow for Education Policy Reporting. Hi, Jess.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. Jeff, Barry, Jorge Valencia are out on assignment today. This is the fourth edition of the WUNC Politics Podcast, now available on iTunes and Google Play, thanks to Keith Weston. And the idea behind it was to be a lively weekly conversation on the many political stories that happen every week in the halls of the General Assembly, where our reporters spend so much of their time, and also on the campaign trails, where they will be soon and have been in the past. The idea was to talk about and analyze many stories, but the ones we can't get on air on WUNC because of time and space or whatever. And, of course, what's happened is kind of the exact opposite. We focused almost all of our political podcasts on HB2. Every day there's a new twist and turn in that story. It's dominated the news cycle and brought sustained national, international attention to the state. Today, let's take a slightly different approach to talking about HB2. I want to focus on discussing three people and how they're shaping the debate and the future of the law. They are Loretta Lynch, U.S. Attorney General, Margaret Spellings, UNC System President, and Hunter Schaefer, a student at the North Carolina School of the Arts. First, Loretta Lynch.
It was not so very long ago that states, including North Carolina, had other signs above restrooms, water fountains, and on public accommodations, keeping people out.
That was Attorney General Loretta Lynch on Monday announcing the Department of Justice had filed suit against North Carolina just a few hours after Governor Pat McCrory had filed suit against the federal government. And Jess, you watched Lynch's press conference. Her speech was pretty powerful, and she drew a straight line between HB 2 and the Civil Rights era.
She certainly did. She talked about, you know, these are signs above restrooms that are similar to signs we saw above other signs we saw above restrooms and water fountains. And she's drawing a direct line there between a time in the not too distant past where we had signs for people of color and signs for white people above restrooms and water fountains, et cetera. So that was pretty powerful, direct, strong language.
Yeah.
And she also drew a line to the more recent debate about the right for gay people to marry, and she basically said, whenever you have progress, what she terms as progress in civil rights, you always have pushback from certain states, and so she is saying like this is similar to the Jim Crow laws that we saw in the 1960s, and this is also similar to more recent legislation where states have pushed back against the right to marry for gay and lesbian people.
Right, and she's from North Carolina. She was born in Greensboro, raised right down the street here off of Fayetteville Street in Durham, went to the old Durham High School, valedictorian, went to Harvard. You know, she's had experiences here. Her father still lives here in Durham. A lot of experiences. You could see that it wasn't just kind of an abstract thing for her.
No.
She was drawing a real straight line to her own personal experiences, which is what I found really interesting. What was also interesting is to sort of compare her very specific remarks to Governor McCrory's very specific remarks earlier in that day and other people we've seen. And there was a lot of – I think there was a lot of passion in this issue. And it's really interesting to watch – people who have to take the lead because they're in a position where they don't have any choice. And then there are people who take the lead because they feel strongly about it.
Right.
And I think that's where you saw the difference maybe between McCrory and Loretta Lynch. Lynch, it seemed like, was really more personally invested.
She seemed personally invested. And I think with some of the most powerful language, besides the kind of historical memory that she brought to bear, was when she was talking directly to transgender people and saying, hey, we've got your back. And that was very, very powerful. And, you know, not something that I guess you know, I haven't heard her speak before, but it was not something that I expected the attorney general to say.
Yeah.
It was just very direct and straightforward.
Yeah, and there's the legal fight that's going to be going on with HB2, which we'll talk about as we move along in
right.
on future podcasts. But there's also the public relations battle that's sort of playing out in the public sphere. And you're watching the governors appearing on national shows, radio shows, Meet the Press, Fox News Sunday,
yeah.
all of those different shows. He may be on NPR soon. We were hearing he may be doing an interview today that would appear on NPR. It's interesting what he's chosen to do. Loretta Lynch has only chosen to make that one statement, impact. But we're going to see a lot more of this sort of back and forth in the media and trying to sway public opinion. You've watched this. You've seen public opinion from various stages. It still plays out very much in this state, it seems to me, as this rural-urban divide. That's certainly not across the board. There are plenty of people in urban areas who support HB2.
Right.
There are plenty of people in rural areas who oppose HB2, but in general, you're seeing the support in the cities against HB2, and then you're seeing support for HB2 in the rural areas. Is that what you're seeing as you travel around?
Yeah, I definitely think that's the case. And I will say that I don't think that's because there are more transgender people in the cities than there are in rural areas.
Proportionally.
Right. I think that in rural areas, they tend to be more conservative culturally. And so someone who's transgender might, one, not know, have kind of the education around that issue to feel comfortable coming out or to access the resources. Because of that, people in the rural areas may know fewer transgender people.
Or think they know fewer
right. transgender people or gender nonconforming people. And so you have less of an understanding of that. And so people are more likely to see this abstractly.
Right.
And that can, you know, cause people to not know the issues and, not support
right.
those rights.
Right. Or, you know, they support what they know. You know?
Right,
and,
right.
And it's understandable really in any walk of life. But one of the interesting things sort of playing on that is President Obama just today issued a sweeping directive telling every public school district in the country to allow transgender students to use the bathrooms that match their gender identity. He clearly believes, and the Obama administration clearly believes, they're going to prevail in the courts.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not in the first initial wave of court decisions, maybe in the Fourth Circuit, maybe even in the Supreme Court. But clearly with this kind of directive, you're thinking he sees this as a fight he's going to win as things move forward. You've spent a lot of time in public schools in North Carolina, in the Triangle, outside the Triangle. How do you think this directive is going to play in schools around the state?
I think very similar to what we've been seeing in other areas. I think, you know, there's going to be that rural-urban split where you're going to have schools in the more rural areas of the state are going to push back more against this directive. And schools in urban areas are already doing this.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you're going to see kind of the same thing.
It might also be a question of resources. You know, if you have to reconstruct some physical space to accommodate this, rural schools just simply don't have as much money to do this. And you can bet they're not going to get money from the state to do this. They may get money from the federal government to do this. But it's also, you know, that'll take time. Resources aren't as available in the rural schools as they are in the urban schools.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it would take money to construct gender neutral bathrooms. But I think this directive really allows people to use the restrooms of their choice. So they would be able to use existing bathrooms. So
right.
I don't know that resources would be as big an issue as they already have been made by HB2, which allows people to use gender nonconforming bathrooms.
Right.
So,
and this will put school officials sort of in the same boat as Margaret Spellings, president of the UNC system, who is at this moment trying to decide which law to follow and which law to not follow. And the UNC system president has only been on the job a few months. And she's kind of in this no-win situation, right? She either follows the state law and potentially lose billions in federal funding down the road, or she follows the federal law and potentially anger lawmakers in Raleigh and lose just tens of millions of dollars in state funding.
You know, yeah, she's, or her job.
Or her job, right. You know, she and other people in her administration are spending a lot of time in Raleigh trying to, you know, convince lawmakers that they need more money for the UNC system. That's a big part of what she does. And she's trying to walk this tightrope now with HB2. How does she do that? I mean, how is she going to be able to – I mean, you saw her press conference. She came out and spoke. You covered that event this week. Does she seem as confused as you might expect her to seem?
I think she's been doing – I don't know how confused she is. She's really good at staying cool. But I think she's done a really good job so far of walking that line. It's really hard to tell, it's hard for everyone to tell how she's going to be able to do this. But I think she said a few things during the press conference that kind of tipped me off to, okay, this is maybe how she's going to do it. So she said that, she doesn't think that by complying with HB2, the university system is violating Title VII of the Civil Rights Act or Title IX of the Education Amendments of 1972. At the same time, she expressed a desire to make all students feel comfortable and to comply with federal law. And she also brought up the fact that HB2 doesn't have any enforcement provision.
Right.
So it kind of says to me, okay, we're complying with state law because we say we're complying with it, but we're complying with federal law because we're not enforcing these provisions, which the feds say are discriminatory. So I think that's how she's kind of walking that line so far, but it's not really clear, and she's seeking legal representation for the system now. So I think we'll have a better idea of their argument once those lawsuit documents become public.
Well, let's hear a little bit of what she had to say this week.
We have not changed any of our policies. There are no enforcement positions in House Bill 2, and that will, you know, continue to be our stance. We've not violated any provision of Title IX or Title VII as it relates to House Bill 2.
That's Margaret Spellings, president of the UNC system. One of the interesting things about what she has to do, not only between the state and federal government, she has a board of governors. That she has to manage has to have a lot of different opinions.
Mm-hmm.
That's also interesting as moving forward on this. But now I want to go to somebody who's actually a student in the UNC system, even though she's a high school student. Hunter Schaefer, she is somebody who you profiled her and her family in a sort of pretty remarkable way. I mean, it was a great piece that you had this week. We're going to play it at the end of our conversation here. But why don't you tell us real quick who Hunter Schaefer is and what's her role in sort of this whole HB2 debate?
Hunter Schaefer is 17 years old. She is a high school student at the UNC School of the Arts in Winston-Salem. Hunter was designated male at birth, and she transitioned to female her freshman year of high school. At the time, she was at Broughton High School in Raleigh. And her parents say... since the time Hunter was 2 years old, they could tell that Hunter was not acting like the other little boys that they knew in their life. Hunter was different. And Hunter expressed preferences for more feminine things and feminine expressions from the time she was very young. So you'll hear more about that later in the piece, but... Hunter eventually transitioned, and now she identifies as a transgender girl. And because of HB2 and because she attends a public high school, she has to use the men's restroom. And she is not comfortable with that. She says it makes her feel uncomfortable, and she worries about how it will make the men in the bathroom feel because Hunter looks like a woman. She looks like a girl. So she is suing the state for the right to use the women's restroom.
Right. So she's a central figure in one of the many lawsuits going on.
Right.
Which, you know, if you think back to when I was 17, it's pretty amazing, I think, whenever we see younger people who are willing to take a stand like that. If you agree, if you disagree, whatever. Young people who are willing to be a party to these larger issues takes a certain amount of bravery. And again, it doesn't matter what side of the issue you believe.
Right.
You've got to at least admire somebody's willingness to have the strength of their convictions and follow through on that. So
yeah.
Well, there's a lot more going on in the General Assembly next week than just HB2. Of course, that could take a lot of twists and turns. We'll spend more time probably talking about that in the future. But for now, we're going to this podcast and probably future podcasts, we're going to talk a lot about HB2 and the political ramifications and some of the legal ramifications. But this was a good conversation. Thanks, Jess, for doing it.
No problem.
Make sure to subscribe to the WUNC Politics podcast on iTunes and Google Play and follow all of the WUNC Politics stories from Jess and Jeff Tiberi and Jorge Valencia on air and online. See you next week. And now here's Jess's story on Hunter Schaefer and her family.
Before North Carolina and the federal government began suing each other over House Bill 2, several residents filed their own federal lawsuit against the state, calling it discriminatory. One plaintiff is Hunter Schaefer, a transgender high school student from Raleigh. Her parents are Katie Schaefer and Pastor Max Schaefer. They shared their story with WUNC reporter Jess Clark. Hunter transitioned from male to female her freshman year of high school. But as Hunter explains, the change was a long time coming.
I've always had this persistent, need for femininity and, expressing that ever since I was, teeny tiny, toddler.
I would say age two, we'd show Hunter all the superheroes, and he would want Catwoman or Hawk Girl. And I'm saying he because he was our oldest child and our son.
I remember going to pick Hunter up at fashion design camp, and they had a fashion show the final night of camp, and Hunter came up to me the morning before the fashion show and said, "Dad, do you mind if I wear heels?" Inside, everything in me was going, no, no, no. It was that resistant part. But outside, I said, yes.
I came out as gay to my parents in middle school and that a gay boy at this time.
We were going to love our kid no matter what. Everybody was on board, but it didn't move forward from there. I just didn't understand why it was still so difficult to buy clothing. If I took Hunter to the mall, I didn't understand if Hunter, is a gay male, why can't you walk into something like The Gap and buy some clothes? Why is this always an issue?
I was always trying to dress a little more androgynously. I tailored a lot of my jeans and, took them in so that they were almost skin tight and tried to kind of wear bigger t-shirts to cover my upper body so that you couldn't really tell. It was about in seventh grade when I kind of came to terms with the idea that maybe I wasn't a boy. There were two or three occasions where I had brought it up with them, and the first two didn't go very well. It just kind of ended in tears and awkwardness.
I remember saying to Hunter, well, just because you're an artist and just because you like pretty things, that doesn't mean you're transgender. It doesn't mean you're a girl.
It became harder than Hunter being gay because I thought, this is not something that will just be who Hunter is on the inside and maybe expressed in relationships, but how Hunter even appears has the potential to change.
The third time, it was later in the year, and I could start seeing peach fuzz on my upper lip.
The anxiety level in Hunter was so apparent.
It's mostly this feeling of just dread and wrongness. Especially facial hair just terrified me. That was something that just did not resonate with me at all. And, I can't really explain why. It just was.
You feel those cultural norms that you've been brought up in, and you feel a pressure against them. And then you have to wrestle within yourself, okay, am I going to bend to the cultural norms that I was raised with and have come before me? Or am I going to be honest about who my child is saying they are?
I remember there were lots of tears. It was kind of just this reality of we were going to have to let go of who we thought our kid was going to be. This was not going to be my son that was going to grow up and play lacrosse and be some rough and tumble. It wasn't going to happen. And not that there had been a lot of indication that's what it would be, but there were some things that had to be put away.
We met up with an endocrinologist,
Dr. Atkins at Duke. And Dr. Atkins showed us a study, actually, about trans kids, and particularly with the onset of puberty, the anxiety that is produced when you feel like your body's becoming someone that you are not. And so hormone blockers were a path to allow some time for Hunter to think through, is this really who I am?
You could look in hindsight, and everything was leading up to this moment, because I look back now and I think, how could I have not known Hunter was transgender? I just didn't know the word, it needed a name.
4 months after coming out to them, I had my first injection of hormone blockers, which was like a huge weight off my shoulders, because, you know, this pressing angst that like a puberty was approaching, and it was the opposite of what I wanted. All of a sudden, like, that wasn't there anymore. This is a poem that my dad gave me, and I thought it was really awesome, and like relative to like identity and whatnot.
It's like a 12th century Sufi poet, Hafiz, from a book called The Gift.
But it says, the small man builds cages for everyone, he knows, while the sage, who has to duck his head when the moon is low, keeps dropping keys all night long for the beautiful, rowdy prisoners.
That was high school student Hunter Schaefer and her parents Mac and Katie Schaefer. That story was produced by Jess Clark.